Hey, this is Chris from Pleasure Mechanics, and today we are joined by a very special guest, Julie Sandra Decker. Julie's been a prominent voice for the asexual community since 1998, spreading asexuality awareness through her popular videos and blogs. She most recently published an amazing book called The Invisible Orientation, which is a comprehensive look at asexuality and I think is a must-read for anyone looking to understand the human sexual experience. We are so thrilled to welcome Julie Sandra Decker to Speaking of Sex today. Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for asking me on.
Absolutely. So your book is a really generous, comprehensive look at asexuality. Yet many people have never heard of asexuality or don't quite understand what it means. So let's get started with the basics. What is asexuality?
Most people define it as a lack of sexual attraction. There are people who prefer to say asexuality for me means I don't want to introduce sex into my relationships, or that I don't enjoy sex, or I don't find sex intrinsically rewarding. But the sexual attraction aspect seems to be the most popular definition, and that's how I define it for myself as well. I'm not sexually attracted to people.
And can you dive deeper a little bit into sexual attraction versus sexual behavior and sex drive?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we do end up separating those concepts a lot in the asexual community because for most people, they do seem kind of like a package deal most of the time. So, you know, if you're experiencing sexual attraction, you'll probably be sexually aroused by that person and you'll probably want to have sex with that person, regardless of whether you actually would. But for asexual people, we'll experience some of those things, but not theirs. Not all of us will experience all of those things or any of those things. But if we're not experiencing sexual attraction to someone, that doesn't mean that we couldn't enjoy a sexual experience of some kind. So some asexual people do still have sex and may even enjoy sex, but that is still kind of a minority of the community. A lot of us prefer to be abstinent or only have occasional or very rare or no sex at all. So, but it does not mean we are celibate. There is a difference between behavior and attraction. And we definitely like to focus on that a lot in our community because we do hear a lot of criticism along the lines of, why don't you just call it what it is, celibacy? And that is not accurate. So we definitely like to say that those are two different things.
And you talk about celibacy being a choice, a behavior, versus asexuality being an orientation.
Is that right? Yes, and I guess you could frame it as, say, it is possible for a gay man to have sex with a woman or enjoy sex with a woman without saying, I'm attracted to that woman. So that's kind of where we are. Whatever we do with our sex lives and our sexual behavior, including maybe even self-pleasure, those are all in separate categories from the attraction aspect, which is who we find attractive. And for those of us who are asexual, we just don't consider people to be sexually attractive to us.
Beautiful. And so you just released this book, which I think is going to become the go-to guide about asexuality, but you've been talking about it publicly for much longer. What prompted you to start your YouTube series and start writing publicly about asexuality?
Really, it was just a lark at first. I had my own personal website in the late 90s where I would rant about various things that irritated me, just rambles about my college roommate or running out of toilet paper. I literally had a rant about running out of toilet paper. And so one of the things that irritated me a lot in college, as you might imagine, is that people were always propositioning me and harassing me about why don't I have a boyfriend and why don't I consider them for my boyfriend? And, you know, I would say, I'm not attracted to you. I've never been interested in anyone that that way. So I started to receive in my early 20s, I started to receive all these comments like, you need to get checked out. You probably just hate men. You probably just got out of a bad relationship. So I just started to collect all of these criticisms, and I made a top 10 list, and I took each one and I deconstructed it as to why that was not my problem. And I put it on a website, and that is what led to just kind of a trickle of mail from people who said that they felt similarly. And that was the first I realized, wow, I might not actually be the only person who feels this way. And eventually that was what led to me getting my first mainstream media interview. I think that was in Salon in 2005. And sometime after that, I decided to explore a different medium because not everybody likes to read long-winded essays by random internet girls. So I decided to do a visual aspect, and I kind of made a video version of my top 10 and went on from there to read my hate mail to the internet, and people seemed to find it entertaining. But it, of course, also attracted a lot more detractors and a lot more stuff to add to my list. And it grew up kind of the center of other communities that were forming that were using my videos as resources and leaning on them to help educate others. So I figured, you know, I'm doing a pretty decent job of this, but I felt like I needed to dive into the community to understand the other people in it. And from there, I just started doing more interaction with the Tumblr AVEN, which is the Asexual Visibility and Education Network. It is an asexual specific message board. And, you know, just get to know kind of the huge spectrum of different people who are identifying as asexual. And from there, I just decided the last thing we don't have is a book. So there is a textbook written not from an asexual perspective by a professional. I guess he's a Anthony Bogart is a a psychologist, I think. And he's written about asexuality from an academic perspective, but it's not really for the layman or the layperson, I should say. And other than that, we just had internet essays and self-published books. So that's why I went for it.
Awesome. I'm so glad you did. And I'm curious, you estimate the asexual population as about 1% of population by the best guesses. And do you think the internet is kind of uniquely responsible for bringing together the asexual community? Because there's not, as you say in the book, there's not asexual nights at the club or at GLBT centers. Did this community really fortify itself online?
I would say definitely the internet has helped a lot with the connection aspect. Before that, asexual people were usually going to be the only person who identified that way in their whole social group. And it's very, very difficult to find other people who were identifying the same way unless you happened to be really lucky. So the internet has always been a good place to start with outreach, finding unpopular opinions. So yeah, I would say that the internet has been instrumental in our ability to form a community of people who are otherwise isolated. But that 1% figure came before all that. That came in a large sexuality study that actually Anthony Bogart was involved in, and he saw that 1% of the people in this large British study were reporting that they weren't attracted to anybody. So that was where the research started for him. And that number, he has said in recent years in a radio interview that he thinks it's still a pretty accurate number, 1%, 1 in 100.
Interesting. And you call the book Invisible Orientation. And I do imagine that asexuality is a part of your identity that is invisible unless you really bring it to the forefront, because you don't say, hey, mom, here's my gay boyfriend, or it's not a orientation identity that's easily seen. What do you think is the value of making it more publicly aware of asexuality and bringing it into the conversation about human sexuality in general?
I think that it really needs to be brought up, partly because, like the title of the book says, it is otherwise invisible because of the heteronormative assumptions about everybody that you don't know anything about. You assume they're straight. You assume they're cisgender. And you assume a whole lot of things about them if they're so-called non-practicing or you can't see any partner for them. Then you would assume that they're probably a straight person who can't find a partner. Right. And if they were to be, say, heteroromantic, which would be an asexual person who is romantically attracted to a cross-sex partner, when you have a cross-sex partner, when your partner is a different gender than you, people are just assuming that's a heterosexual relationship. And some people are comfortable with that. Some people say, I don't want to include anybody else in my private life. They don't need to know that my feelings about that person aren't sexual. But for a lot of us, especially those of us who don't engage in relationships or engage in them in an unusual way, it is very difficult to find connection and is very difficult to be accepted by the people that are close to us in our lives. They often worry about us. They assume that we have a mental problem or a psychological problem, and there can be an awful lot of pressure to conform or to get fixed if there isn't education about this.
Amazing. And I think that's one of the things the book does so beautifully, is it really breaks down so many facets of attraction, romance, sexuality into components, and then makes it really clear that we each have our own unique constellation of identity, and it doesn't have to be a package deal. And I think that can be so liberating for people to understand that they might be asexual but have romantic attraction or have neither. Can you talk a little bit about the difference as you see it between sexual attraction, romantic attraction, and sensual attraction?
Sure. Yeah. So sexual attraction, romantic attraction, sensual attraction, those are, again, usually a package deal for, most people. The person they're attracted to, all they have to say is, I'm attracted to that person. And everybody knows what you mean. But asexual people, if they're not experiencing the sexual aspect of that, but they still say, oh, I'm romantically attracted to you. I like you in this way that I would define as romantic, but I don't feel sexually toward you. There's just this immense response from the rest of the world saying, that is not a romance. That cannot be a romance. That is a friendship. Mm-hmm. And the people that are actually involved in it say, no, that's really, I feel romantic about that person. And it's kind of startling sometimes how violently people are opposed to this idea that it cannot be romantic without sex. But that is what they're experiencing. And personally, I think that in consensual adult relationships, people should be trusted to describe their experiences as what they feel that they are. And I don't understand why people are sometimes get so invested in denying that that is a romantic relationship, because the people in it aren't banging. So, but then there are people who sensual attraction, they may like being touched by a person. They may like being touched in certain ways. They may find another person to be aesthetically or sensually appealing, but that doesn't inspire sexual attraction in them. So in the asexual community, a lot of times we have to break things up into different terms to understand to what extent we might be interested in intimacy and in what ways with partners that we may or may not want to engage with. So that's why we talk about these different categories of attraction, so that we can have less confusion and more illumination into what we're willing to do in our relationships and what makes us happy.
And you say, just like with any sexual orientation, asexuality is not neat and clean for everyone. And some people use the term gray sexuality. What does that term mean for people?
gray sexual or gray asexual are terms that have developed in our community for people who are somewhere in the middle. They may say that they experience sexual attraction very, very rarely or only under really unusual circumstances. They've only maybe felt it toward two people in their lives, or maybe it takes a long time to develop. It's just for people who feel like most of the time they identify with an asexual experience, and they may have thought they were asexual for most of their lives, and then they actually do experience a sexual attraction, regardless of whether they end up in a relationship with that person or end up having sex with that person. There's this something that wasn't there before, or something they recognize as that was a sexual attraction. And then it may be the last time that they feel it, or it may be only with that one person, but nobody else seems sexy in that way. And that is enough of a distinction for some people to say, I feel more comfortable using a different term for my orientation so that I can better communicate to other people what they can expect and what I can expect in my attraction reactions.
So it strikes me that this is really a case where developing language as a community and having these terms to describe the experience can really change your personal experience of these feelings from one of isolation and feeling broken in some way to a sense of belonging and making sense of yourself. Has that been your experience personally, or have you seen people whose lives have really been changed by accessing the community and starting to understand themselves through these terms?
Oh, wow. I absolutely agree that the language has really helped develop confidence and more ability to function for some of these people. Because without the language, without the connection, without the community, there are a lot of isolated people out there who have nothing except for what's on TV, what's coming from their potential partners, and what's coming from their family and friends in the way of, you have to do this or you're not normal. You need to get that fixed. There's no perspective that maybe there are ways that are okay that the person can continue to let their personal desires guide what they want rather than these external messages. So being able to access community has been transformative for so many people. And I get those emails pretty much daily from people who say, thank you so much for giving me the words. Thank you so much for giving me an access to these concepts to know that alone. Interestingly, some of these terms are also very, very helpful for people who are not asexual, not just in understanding asexual spectrum people, but I went to a conference last year where I met someone who identified as, she was not asexual, but she was aromantic, which meant for her that, you know, I don't fall in love and I don't experience romantic attraction, but I still find people to be sexually attractive. And that's shamed in our society. It's less shamed by men or for men, but women who just want to have sex with other people or enjoy sex with other people but don't want to form attachments, that's almost unheard of. But the term aromantic for that woman made her think, oh, well, this is a thing. This is something other people feel. Maybe it's not so ridiculous. Maybe it's not something I need to go see a therapist about and fix.
Right. And you talk about how you can identify as heteroromantic, but bisexual or vice versa. I think all of this language gives us all permission and even encourages us to really look at our own experiences, our own feelings, and map out our own truths rather than take these package deals that society is trying to hand to us, which of course for the longest time was just heterosexuality, and now we've expanded it to including more gay and lesbian lifestyles and bisexuality. And when I was reading the book, you go through a lot of myths about asexuality, and it strikes me how many parallels there are to the queer experience, from things like your orientation must be a result of sexual trauma, or maybe you should get your hormones checked, or it's just a phase, you'll grow out of it, you haven't met the right person yet. And it really strikes me that these sexual identities, sexual orientations can help one another in awareness. And I'm just curious what you've learned from the gay rights movement that's informed your own efforts in asexual awareness, and how parallel you see these communities to be.
Oh yeah, there's definitely just a whole host of parallel between our communities. There, I would say that the biggest, I guess, difference is that there aren't really institutional efforts to, you know, silence and shame asexual people because it's invisible, and the ways that those institutional pressures do manifest are not, don't use the word asexual in the language. But for on a lot of levels, we are definitely experiencing similar types of discrimination and sometimes prejudice. And from, you know, from our friends, from our families, from potential partners, from society. And yeah, there's I've definitely had several experiences where I've been invited into queer spaces, and I have learned in what ways we have different fights, but also that we, if we are actually interested in being allies for each other, we should support those regardless of whether we're included personally or just as an ally. I've learned stuff like that one good way for us, for asexual people who do not also identify as any LGB or T identities, to support LGBT rights would be to inform ourselves through watching queer media and things like that, that we don't have to necessarily be considered part of the movement in order to be decent allies to it, and that we should be decent allies to it if we ever expect to join forces. Because there are sometimes a little bit of bad blood between just certain people who feel like, well, you're claiming that you've been oppressed and you haven't been because I can't see it and I don't believe you. So I find it offensive that you would ever want to come into my community or suggest that your struggles are anything like mine. So I do like to emphasize that there are different struggles, there are different experiences, and I definitely would say that asexual people have a lot to learn from watching how these fights have progressed. But I would also say that it's an umbrella in the first place, and there absolutely aren't any two people within the LGBT community who have the identical experience to each other. So I think that it needs to be more on an individual basis, like, oh, you have analogous issues to mine, and we can learn from each other as to how to foster our true selves in response to a heteronormative pressure of a greater society.
And speaking of allyship, I love the statement you make in the book that, quote, a big part of being an ally is being one even when there are no asexual people around to appreciate it. So what can people do to become an ally to the asexual community?
Well, most notably, of course, if you know an asexual person, you should always do more listening about their experience than talking. You should never just lay down conditions for belief or search for a way to invalidate them. But overall, I think that it's just about keeping an open mind and understanding that there's aspects of sexuality that are poorly understood, and that individuals need to be the ones to be trusted to describe what they're feeling and experiencing. If your first inclination is to respond to that person with, okay, hold up here, we need to interrogate you and figure out how it could possibly be anything else before you use this as your last resort. And asexuality isn't a last resort. It's always a reasonable possibility for someone. So there shouldn't be like this drive to make sure that they're not anything else. Although I do understand that some people who are responsible for the health of others just want to make sure that their loved one isn't sick or suffering. So the book does go a little into some of my dysfunctions and some disorders and diseases that do have sexual components and sexual arousal problems that are associated with diseases, but those are not definitive of asexuality, and they all have additional symptoms. So asexuality itself isn't a disorder, and I give a few bullet points as to what to look for if you think it might be an illness. But other than that, I would say default to belief and default to listening. And again, like you said, being an ally, even when no asexual people are there to appreciate it, the rules of thumb are disagree with anybody who says things like sex is part of being human, or equates wanting sex as a definitive human need. Those are just some invalidating statements that can really alienate asexual people, and they foster this belief that you're really not a part of the species if you don't do this. And that has definitely been something that has been damaging to us as a community, individual asexual people, of course.
Wow, that's really profound. And, especially I live as a full-time sex educator, and all of my daily tasks are around assisting people with their sex lives. And so I'm sure that I can fall into that trap sometimes. And I think it's interesting because romance and sexuality are this huge organizing principle for so many people's lives. And so it becomes hard to imagine how you organize your identity and your life without romance or without sexuality. So can you share a little bit about the other facets of your identity, and particularly ones that bring you pleasure and joy and even sensuality? How do you find those aspects of your life without sex? Does that make sense?
Personally, I identify as an aromantic, asexual woman, and I'm a little bit on the introverted side. I'm not that into having, a lot of social interaction, but I have several very close friends, and I see my friends on a regular basis, and I kind of prefer, individual gatherings, one or two people to hang out and talk, and we usually do things like, bake together and draw together, I'm close with my family as well. So there are a lot of interpersonal relationships that I have that I value, and being that I don't have a primary partner, I wouldn't say that my best friends are a replacement for that in any way. I feel like I don't have a partner, and I'm happier as a partnerless person. I have no significant other, but I do consider the others in my life to be significant, and I think that our society is, we're always putting the word just in front of friends, as if friends just can never be a fulfilling thing. It's always somehow secondary or a disappointment when compared with romantic relationships, but that's not how it is for me. And then, personally, outside of my social relationships, I really enjoy, of course, writing, and I'm an artist, and I like singing, and I have a whole lot of creative activities that I really enjoy engaging in. So, I have a very full life with those and interaction on the internet, and I like to play tennis, and, you know, just I do the same things most people do. I just don't I don't share those things with a partner, and I prefer living by myself.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because constantly as sex educators, we're encouraging people to find other pleasures in their life and other relationships so they don't put so much importance on their primary sexual relationship as their sole source of fulfillment. And I think there's a lot to be learned from people who find so many ways to enrich their lives and engage with the world sensually. You mentioned baking and crafting and singing and things like gardening, which are all incredibly sensually aware activities that nourish you and actually make the same chemical cocktails in your body that sexuality does. And in the ways that we talk about sexuality being a source of health because of things like oxytocin and dopamine, there are so many ways to trigger those sensual pleasures in our bodies. And I think we all need to diversify so we don't put so much emphasis and become so desperate when something is going wrong with our sexuality. So I think there's a lot to be learned there from remembering that, yes, many people find so much pleasure through sexuality, but there is a galaxy of options that are available to us all. And each of us needs to find our unique constellation and what works for us socially and aesthetically and sensually. So thank you for that good reminder for us all. And I think there's just so many lessons in this book that whether or not you're asexual or wondering if you're asexual, whether or not someone you love is asexual, I think everyone can really learn a lot about their self, their sexuality, and what it means to be human from reading this book. And I really encourage people to pick it up. It's called The Invisible Orientation. And just as a final question, I'm wondering what you think people can learn from the asexual community if we take the time to listen.
What can we learn from the asexual community? I think that we are just another stripe in a diversity rainbow. And that there's nothing all that unique or special about being asexual. We're just another possibility. And it's not something that leaves us outside of what I'm using giant scare quotes here, the human experience. The human experience is something every single one of us is having. And there's no one important aspect of it that you have to fulfill before it's really the human experience. So I think that might be something that would be emphasized by understanding asexual dialogues, because one of the problems that we're always hearing is you're not getting the full experience, you're not really fully taking part in your earthly life. And I would disagree, because for me it would be unnatural to push myself into embracing what everybody else is saying that I need. So emphasizing individually led lives is what I would say asexual people are kind of emphasizing and representing. Other than that, I would just say we are another example of how you can have humanity manifest.
Yeah, and I'm reminded of the essay Compulsory Heterosexuality and the Lesbian Existence, which was an essay by Adrienne Rich, which is kind of core feminist theory that talks about all the ways our culture forces compulsory heterosexuality upon us. And I think now we're starting to think about compulsory sexuality. And I think this is a really poignant moment in the history of human sexuality, where we're looking at these ideas and we can all benefit from them in the way we've all benefited from Adrienne Rich and other lesbian feminist writings that brought these issues to the forefront. So I really thank you for taking the time to write this book and be a voice for the asexual community. And I encourage all of our listeners to take this moment to think about these things, pick up a copy of the book, and really become not only an ally for the asexual community, but also start thinking about your own sexual identity and become more honest and authentic with it. If people want to learn more from you, where can they find you online?
I have my author website is juliesandradecker.com. And all of my social media is linked from there. So that's probably the best place to start. I'm on Twitter and I have a blog. So those are the places you can read my essays. And there's also in one of the sections on my website, there are some asexuality resources for those who want them.
Perfect. So Julie Sandra Decker, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time and your wisdom.
Thank you so much.